You know, before I came here, everything was beautiful. There was all love, no hatred, vast emptiness. Then I was born. You see, we in Alaska, us natives, we should have the right to live out our culture. Something that cannot die. To match this, to take away our culture would be to take away our lives. Everything we knew, everything our parents knew, everything our children should know. The same would be, you see, as far as I can see, the white people have no culture. Their only culture, as far as I see it, is progression in death. To rise, to be to the top, to get to the top, get to their downfall, and it's over. That's all the culture I see. And you see, what they fight for is to stay away, you got Democrats, Republicans, so what? I mean, what they do not want is communism, okay? If this place turned communist, their so-called culture of rise and progression would be at a fail, and they would be nothing and slowly die off. Same as is with us. If in 1991 we cannot get our land and we cannot live the culture as we have always known it, we will have no life, the same as that of the U.S. And if that does so happen, I would probably turn and pray for communism. Because if communism did come into the United States, then we would be able to have our land. Maybe whoever runs the U.S., maybe we'll have to work for that person. But he could care less if we were on our own land, as long as maybe we gave it to him, or if we worked, maybe we would not be able to rise higher than we are. But so what? Our culture, we never cared if we rose higher than anybody else. We lived at peace with the land, with our environment. That's as high as we had to go. I do dearly think we cannot have our culture removed. It is all of us. If we could not have our land, if we could not fish, if that is all taken away from us, I would truly turn communist. Because at least then we would have that what we wanted. If we had to work for someone else, so what? We would have our land, and we would be working for ourselves. That which we make would be for ourselves. You cannot depart us from what is ours. We will always be. Thank you.
Oh, could we have your name?
Franklin James, Jr.
Thank you, Mr. James. One of the things that we've been looking into is the way in which Native people have fared in other countries, including the communist countries. And in the Soviet Union, as far as we can tell, Native people are no better off than they are in the United States or Canada. And because the Soviets are very secretive about what is happening there, it is difficult to get very much information about the conditions in the villages where Native people live, and so the only conclusion we can draw is that the Soviets don't want anybody to see what has happened to those folks. I only mention that because it seems to me that you have the advantage here of being able to speak up and fight for your rights. And I don't think there's any place far off where things have worked out really all that well. But there is a worldwide movement, you know, by Native peoples. We've had Native people from all over the world get in touch with our commission and say, look, what happened to those Alaska Natives? We heard about that settlement back in 71. We now want to settle our claims. And so we have had representatives from Canada and Greenland and Norway, Australia and Hawaii, all coming to Alaska to participate in our hearings because they wanted to tell us about what had happened in their countries, and they wanted to learn what had happened, to learn about what had happened in Alaska. But it is a worldwide movement. I think the best evidence of that was when Pope John Paul II visited the Native people in the Canadian Arctic last year. He made a speech to the Native people, and he was addressing Native people all over the world, Canada, the United States, everywhere. And he said, you are entitled, you Native people, to take your rightful place among the peoples of the earth. He said, you are entitled to self-determination. You are entitled to a land base. It was a speech worth looking at, worth reading. And that I mentioned to you because it shows that Native people all over the world are starting to say, wait a minute, this land was ours before all these other folks came. We have certain rights because we are the indigenous people, the original people. And what they are doing in many countries is trying to work out those rights. What does it all mean in 1985 to be an Indian or Eskimo or Aleut or Sami or Hawaiian or Maori? And I think nothing but good can come of all of these people in all of these countries getting to know more about what is happening elsewhere. Well, Mr. James was kind of got me musing on the subjects, and I forgive me. Yes, someone has their hand up over here. I guess not. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Franklin H. James, Sr. I was born and raised in Alaska. I'm a Sea Alaska shareholder. And I had some little notes here. I wanted to read one here, then I got some outlines I'd like to discuss my feelings on. It says, what organization was it that won us our land suit? Was it Sea Alaska? No. What organization was it that fought and won such rights as going to school, riding the same bus, eating the same restaurants, and going to the same movie halls as the white people? Was it Sea Alaska? No. Who was this organization that done all this for us? It was the Alaska Native Brotherhood. After winning this suit, why didn't Congress hand everything over to the Alaska Native Brotherhood? That's what I'd like to know. Why didn't they? When a white man goes to court and wins, does the judge award it to somebody else to take care of his property so he can handle it? No, that's what I don't understand. Why did Congress set something up to give it to somebody else to handle it? Such people as Sea Alaska, who are they? Who were they? There are some people that negotiated our rights away. To me, I'd rather have them have that $1 billion. What is that $1 billion? I'd rather have my fishing hunting rights. What does this land mean to you? It means lots to me. But what good is it doing us now? That's what I'd like to know. What good is it going to do us after 1991? Will you guys be able to fish there, hunt there, build on there? No. You'd be no better off than you are today. It seems to me that when you in a suit, you should handle your own land that you had won. Not some newly formed corporation, such as Sea Alaska. Who gave them the power to negotiate a rights way? Did these few people set up these guidelines for their own personal gains? When Alaskan natives won this great land suit, who was supposed to benefit by it? The Alaskan native or the non-native? To me, these 14 years later, it seems that just a handful of natives and the rest non-natives are the only people that are benefiting. Do you think that after 14 years, the directors in Sea Alaska have done a good job? If you ask me, the answer is no, I don't. The directors that ruled and controlled the board since 1971 have made nothing but bad mistakes, bad investments. There have been no controls over salaries. They are always making excuses for what they have done, never telling the truth, and never giving us a true audit. They are always telling us how good our companies are doing. You know, just for instance, one of our companies that we bought had a good track record from the beginning until when Sea Alaska bought it. What happened? They said we lost $6 million that 1 year on botulism. No, we lost $28 million. The next year says, well, we're getting better, we made $3 million profit. Always wondered what they called making a profit. We only lost $25 million that year, so we didn't quite lose 28. Yet they said we made $23 million profit. I mean, $3 million profit. Those 2 years, we went $53 million in a hole. You know, how come that when we bought a place that had a good track record at this one company, 1 year just about broke even, the rest were all good years. I really don't understand why that we took such a tremendous loss. Where is that money going? We make $127 million a year in that one company, yet there's no profits. We still have to keep borrowing from the bank to try to pay on the principal. Something's wrong. You know, what do we as shareholders want in 1991? Now, my personal feelings in 1991 is that I'd like to keep my land, if there's any there to keep. But I believe each shareholder has a right to do what they want to do with that land. If they want to sell it, they should be able to sell it. If they want to keep it, keep it. If they want to pass it on to their kids, fine. But I believe in 1991 that land should be given to us. Not just sit there like it's sitting there right now. A few bunch of loggers coming from the stateside in Canada to log it. We don't see nothing from it. And I don't think we ever will. Are you pleased with Sea Alaska's handling our subsidiaries? I'm not. Another thing, do you think Sea Alaska and the other 12 regions and AFN are railroading us on those 8 stipulations they gave to us? I think they are. I think they should give us time. Let us vote on it when this next election comes. Let them put it on little pamphlets that is trying to shove it in and costing us I forgot what their expenses just for traveling was, $220,000. And yet they're not going to listen to us anyway, even though we gave them our negative reports. Another thing, you know, as a shareholder, I believe our older people that fought like my parents did, and they're not here today, they really fought for this land, fought hard. They scraped every penny they had, but they never benefited a thing out of it. I believe some of our elder peoples, when 1991 comes, should be able to sell their land if they want. Let them live their last few years in comfort if there's any money to be given to them. You know, it always reminds me, it's lucky it's a beautiful day out today. But usually one of the biggest meetings you ever see that's held on election day, it's always raining. Why is it raining so hard? You know, you sit there and think, that's all your people up there. You know, they look at you and see, geez, everyone, all this land for these people. You know, you look up there and see, are they crying? You guys got to think, what do we want to do with our land? You know, there's a lot of things I talk about that can go on, but another thing that makes me feel bad, who had the power to say that you should go to this village, you should go to the 13th region, or belong to one of these other 12 regions? To me, I signed up for a place, but no, they put me at large. A lot of people signed up for different places, as Craig, Heidelberg, Tlaloc, but were thrown into the 13th regions against their wishes. I see a lot of these bad mistakes. I see people that are over a quarter native that can't even get into Sea Alaska. Some that are much as 1/16th belong to Sea Alaska. Now, who had those powers to put these people and say who could come and who couldn't? You know, just the other day, not just the other day, about a month ago, I've been in meetings with this powerful business guy. He's the president of his company. They personally put between $200 to $300 million aside for 1991 to buy us out. You know, maybe we need some new investors to come into our corporation to start making this money. We're not making it. We look at some of our village corporations on the verge of bankruptcy. Some of our regions alone that are on the verge of bankruptcy or bankrupt. Reason why Sea Alaska isn't there, yet we had a little more money and a little more timber than them. We're slowly dying. But something has to be done. I believe myself I won't sell my land. Why? I believe that we are going to have new investors come in after 1991. I believe they are going to make us money. Right today, I see lots of discrimination, lots of nepotism, favoritism, but not towards us. It's towards the non-natives. They get all the benefits, which was supposed to be benefiting us. But I believe with this new investors coming in, you guys will finally start seeing some dividends, and maybe you'll finally start getting some jobs where they can't discriminate against us. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. James.
My name is Dilma Carpenter. I'm an Alaska Native, and I'd like to share some of my points of view and some of my feelings. I feel quite strongly about being an Alaska Native and feel that it's my responsibility to feel and to act that way and to present those kind of ideas and attitudes to my children. Some of the feelings that I have in terms of the Land Claim Settlement Act is that, number one, I resent the fact that some years back Congress made the decision that I wasn't capable of handling my own money and set up the 13 regional corporations and allowed someone else to handle certain portions of my money. To make it matters worse, as far as I'm concerned, that a lot of those people have absolutely no business acumen whatsoever. And that's been shown to me by the fact that all these years I haven't received any dividends for my shares.
Which corporation are you in?
Sea Alaska. The other feeling that I have, I'm absolutely against opening up the shares to present to children born after 1971. I feel that my stock would be diluted so much that one more time I wouldn't get any funds. I would like to suggest to my corporation that they set up some kind of a voting or questionnaires that we can respond to in the mail that are there, that are presented to us without prejudice, without inflicting their particular points of view on us. I would very much like to see us keep our land base, and I'm also for my corporation going public. I would like to see us go ahead and follow general corporate structure. And like I said, at this point, I'm for us opening up to the public because I feel that I would make more profit. And to me, that's what a corporation is, to earn a profit. That's why people buy stock in corporations. And I also resent the fact that the Alaska Federation of Natives has been selected as the spokesperson for me without my having the opportunity to be a part of making that decision. Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Greg O'Leary. I'm an attorney in private practice here in Seattle. Between 1977 and 1979, I worked for Alaska Legal Services Corporation, representing individual Alaska Natives in their attempts to obtain Alaska Native allotments from the United States government. I understand that during earlier hearings, the Commission has received a good deal of testimony about Alaska Native allotments and certain problems associated with them. I would like to address several problems which I see with the current program. And before doing that, I would like to present a little bit of background because it's difficult to understand the comments that I will make later without some context. On December 18, 1971, when the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act passed, approximately 7,400 allotment applications were on file with the Department of the Interior. They were filed under a 1906 act, which allowed individual Alaska Natives to obtain up to 160 acres of land. At the time AGSA passed, Congress, through Section 18 of the Settlement Act, repealed the Alaska Native Allotment Act, but also provided that the allotment applications on file would be saved and processed, and those persons who qualified under the Allotment Act would be given their lands. During the 2 years before the Settlement Act passed, the Rural Alaska Community Action Program and Alaska Legal Services Corporation had mounted a vigorous drive to collect allotment applications. Up to 1960, 54 years after the Allotment Act was passed, only about 80 allotments had been approved. Between 1968 and 1971, close to 7,000 new applications were placed on file, largely through the efforts of individual Native volunteers in the villages and VISTA volunteers who were funded by the Office of Economic Opportunity. The sudden surge in the allotment application rate left BI, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and the Bureau of Land Management, which processes and adjudicates the applications, facing a large, unanticipated administrative burden. The 7,400 allotment applications represented claims to over 16,000 discrete parcels of land scattered across Alaska. Each one had to be separately field examined and separately adjudicated. The process moved very slowly, particularly because most of the resources of the Bureau of Land Management were devoted to adjudicating ANCSA selections by village corporations and regionals, and because of repeated legal challenges to almost all facets of the Interior Department's allotment adjudication process. In 1979, during consideration of bills that would eventually become the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, Congress became concerned with the very slow rate of allotment approval and also with the interaction between allotment claims and village selected lands. The allotment claims had priority over village corporation selections. As a result, the exact configuration and location of lands to be conveyed to the village corporations could not be determined until the allotment claims in a particular area were processed. In some areas, there were as many as 50 or 60 separate allotment claims within an individual township. Congress recognized that unless the allotment process were significantly expedited, it was likely to pose a bottleneck which would slow down conveyances of lands to villages and impede other important policy objectives of the department associated with the Native Claims Settlement Act. Consequently, in response to this recognition, on December 2, 1980, Congress enacted Section 905 of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. That section was designed to statutorily approve, without a showing of use and occupancy, large numbers of allotments subject to certain exceptions that I won't cover in detail here. Generally, the allotments that were not within areas that had been reserved prior to the 1968 land freeze or had not been selected by the state were approved. At the present time, over four years after Section 905 of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act was enacted, there are approximately 2,000 allotment applications remaining to be processed, representing claims to about 3,000 discrete parcels of land. Despite the statutory approval of allotment claims mandated by Congress in 1980, there are still a large number of very significant and very complicated issues to be resolved in the adjudication process. I want to address two of those specifically today, and I'd be happy to respond to any questions you might have, Judge Berger, about other matters. The first issue I would like to address is the question of fair hearings. The Interior Department had long taken the position that allotment applicants were not entitled to oral hearings before Bureau of Land Management decision makers. This position was rooted in the Interior Department's belief that approval of allotment applications was a matter conferred to the sole discretion of the Secretary of the Interior. As a result, when Alaska Natives requested oral hearings before decision makers in order to present evidence about their use of the land, the Interior Department regularly rejected those requests on the grounds that an application could be rejected for any reason, if necessary, by the Secretary of the Interior. More specifically and more technically, the Interior Department took the position that the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution, which ensures due process rights, did not cover allotment claims because an allotment claim was not a claim to a property right under United States law. Simply put, allotments were viewed as the product of the department's largesse under the statute and not as a matter of right. In the early 1970s, individual Native allotment applicants initiated a number of lawsuits challenging the Interior Department's position on approval of allotments and unfair hearings. In 1976, in a case known as Sarah Pence versus Kleppe, which is reported at volume 529, Federal Reporter Second, 135, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected the Interior Department's position. The court held that the Allotment Act granted an entitlement to property under United States law, and that as a result, allotment applicants were entitled to a fair hearing at which to present oral evidence or testimony before the person who would make the decision in their case. This right was based on the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. The Pence case was a certified class action on behalf of all applicants who had ever been rejected by the Interior Department. The effect of the Ninth Circuit's ruling in 1976. Mm-hmm. The effect of the Ninth Circuit's ruling in 1976 was to reopen all claims from 1976 to the present time that had been rejected on factual grounds. The Pence decision is probably the most significant legal development in the history of the allotment program. This is true for several reasons. First, it opened the doors of the Interior Department and of the federal courts to allotment applicants who wished to present evidence of their use and occupancy of the land at a hearing before a judge. Secondly, the reopening of hundreds, if not thousands, of allotment claims by the Pence decision resulted in more liberal rules regarding entitlement to allotments. The Interior Department was facing such a huge administrative burden as a result of the Pence decision that its response was to significantly loosen its earlier very restrictive rules concerning entitlement and approve more cases, more claims. The reason for that is because by approving the individual claims, the department could avoid going to essentially a trial on each individual applicant's allotment claim. The Department of the Interior currently uses what are known as its public contest procedures to determine the entitlement of applicants to lands under the Alaska Native Allotment Act. Those contest procedures are triggered in cases where the Bureau of Land Management decides to reject an allotment that was not statutorily approved by the 1980 ANILCA legislation. Once the determination to reject an applicant is made, a contest complaint is issued. The applicant then has a set period of time to file an answer to the contest complaint, and after filing an answer, the applicant is allowed an opportunity to appear before an administrative law judge of the Department of the Interior, represented by counsel if he wishes to be, and present evidence in support of his claim. At this point, the most critical need with respect to the hearing process is to develop a mechanism for preserving evidence in advance of hearings. as the older generation of Alaska Natives gradually begins to disappear, much evidence that is relevant to use and occupancy of the land during periods which are important under the Alaska Native Allotment Act disappears with them. The fair hearing process is moving extraordinarily slowly. Given that there are approximately 2,000 claims still on file, we can anticipate that the allotment program will not be concluded within the next 10 years, I would guess. As a result, the commission should consider whether to recommend that Alaska Legal Services Corporation receive special funding to take depositions by videotape in the villages in advance of fair hearings. This procedure would allow attorneys representing applicants to go to the villages, videotape the testimony of important witnesses who may not be alive 10 years from now, and preserve that testimony for use in future hearings. The second general issue I would like to address, which is much more technical than the fair hearing issue, concerns applications for allotments in areas that have been withdrawn for particular federal purposes. And here I'm referring to areas such as the Tongass National Forest, the wildlife refuges, and other areas that the President of the United States or the Secretary of the Interior over the years have set aside and removed from availability for disposal under the public land laws. The Interior Department adopted particularly restrictive rules with respect to approval of allotments on lands withdrawn or reserved for various federal purposes, such as power sites, national forests, and wildlife ranges. Because vast areas of Alaska were withdrawn from entry under the public land laws, these rules about withdrawals affected thousands of claims. The Allotment Act specifies that only, quote, unreserved, unquote, lands are available for allotment to individual natives. The Interior Department construed this requirement to permit approval of an allotment application for reserved land if the applicant himself had personally used the land prior to the date of withdrawal. However, if the applicant's family had used the land prior to the date of the withdrawal, and the applicant, because of his young age, or perhaps because he was not born at that time, did not commence use until after the withdrawal, the allotment claim would be rejected on the ground that the land was reserved within the meaning of the statute. By construing the act to require personal use before a withdrawal, the Interior Department effectively denied persons whose families had long used certain tracts for purposes such as fish and hunting camps the opportunity to obtain beneficial title to the land. The native populations in areas of Alaska where there were large and old withdrawals were particularly hard hit by these rules. For example, most land in the Tongass National Forest of southeastern Alaska was withdrawn in the years 1902, 1907, 1909, and 1925. Under the construction of the act requiring personal occupancy prior to the withdrawal date, very few people in the Tongass Forest who filed during the allotment drive between 1968 and 1971 could qualify. And that was true no matter how intensive their use of the land may have been or how long-standing their family's use of the land over generations may have been. The fact of the matter was that the Interior Department viewed the claim as merely the claim of the individual at that time before the department. If that individual had not used the land before 1902, for instance, his claim was rejected, even if it was based on very extensive ancestral use. Challenges to the rule rejecting continuous ancestral use as a basis for an allotment claim were made in a series of class action suits brought in the United States District Court for the District of Alaska in the mid-1970s. Some of these cases were known as Shields versus United States concerning national forest lands, Joseph versus United States concerning vast areas of the Mid-Yukon River drainage which were withdrawn as part of the Rampart power site. Levitt versus United States concerning allotment claims in the National Petroleum Reserve on the North Slope, and Kutchuk versus United States concerning wildlife range lands and other withdrawn areas. The power site and National Petroleum Reserve issues were mooted by the enactment of Section 905 of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, which I alluded to earlier. That section provided for statutory approval subject to certain restrictions of allotments within federal power sites such as the Rampart Power Site and the National Petroleum Reserve. With respect to national forest lands, wildlife refuges, and other withdrawals, the Ninth Circuit has recently upheld the Interior Department's personal use requirement. Those decisions were issued in Shields versus United States involving the Tongass National Forest, a case which the United States Supreme Court declined to hear, and in Kutchuk versus United States, a case involving wildlife refuges, which is currently before the United States Supreme Court for consideration. The United States Supreme Court has not granted a writ of certiorari in that case and has not agreed to hear it to date. Unless the Supreme Court agrees to hear the Kutchuk case, the only recourse for persons seeking allotments on the basis of family or ancestral use will have to be legislative in nature. I suggest that the Commission consider a recommendation that Congress be petitioned to enact legislation specifying that ancestral use and occupancy is a sufficient basis to establish entitlement where the land claimed by the applicant is still in federal ownership, or where the current owner of the land, for instance, a village corporation, is willing to reconvey the land to the United States so that it may be approved under the Allotment Act. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, unless you have some questions, sir.
Yes, well, thank you very much, Mr. O'Leary. I should say, for the benefit of the folks who are present, that O'Leary, I had that right, didn't I?
Yes.
Sir. Yes. At the hearings in Alaska, we've had literally hundreds of complaints about allotments, and so I'm grateful to Mr. O'Leary for these two very constructive suggestions. The first one is quite straightforward, videotaping the evidence of the folks who may not survive until the BIA and BLM have completed processing these things.
Right. This has been a problem already in the Shields case, which I mentioned earlier. The lead plaintiff for the class of applicants in the Tongass Forest, Albert Shields Sr. from the Ketchikan area, died during the course of the litigation. He had a very strong claim. It was necessary for us to substitute his son as the class representative in that case. The obvious problem is that in allotment cases, the entitlement is based on practices that don't leave much evidence on the land. Hunting, fishing, berry picking, wood cutting, use for fish camps in circumstances where the improvements on the land can easily be washed away. Generally, it is the older people who know about the use of these lands during the time period before a withdrawal was issued for the particular lands, and those people are, of course, disappearing. And to combat that natural attrition, it's necessary to use some means prior to fair hearing to get the evidence down, and I think that videotaped depositions would be the way to go.
Yeah. And regarding your second recommendation, what would be the specific improvement on the present state of affairs that would offer?
Okay. Under the present state of affairs, if I were to assume I'm a native and I applied for an allotment before December 18th, 1971, and let's say I applied in the Tongass National Forest and the land I applied for was withdrawn in the year 1902. Well, because I was born in 1948, I cannot qualify under the Interior Department's rules to receive an allotment of that land because my personal use of the land did not precede the withdrawal in 1902. However, it may be, and this was true in many cases, certainly in Albert Shields' case, that my parents and grandparents used the very same tract of land on a seasonal basis as a fish camp. And they may have used that land since time immemorial, but we may be able to prove that they used that land since 1890, for instance. Under the change that I am recommending, if the land were still owned by the federal government today and not conveyed away to a third party, Congress would instruct the Secretary of the Interior to approve my allotment on the basis of my family's use. It's just that simple. Now, there are very complex legal arguments that were advanced in the litigation in these cases. The Ninth Circuit has rejected those arguments. In the most recent case, however, the Akutchuk case, the three judges of the Ninth Circuit who decided the case concluded their opinion by saying that they felt that the applicants had been trapped by the Interior Department's withdrawal process. And although the court could not provide them legal relief, it suggested that the matter be referred to Congress for appropriate legislation. So there is an unusual judicial suggestion in that case that the matter be placed before Congress.
Did you have a question for Mr. O'Leary?
Yes, I have a question for Mr. O'Leary.
Your name again?
My name is George S. James, Jr.
George James, yes.
Yeah, Mr. O'Leary, just like my brother Frank stated earlier, that we did sign for our traditional Indian lands when this lawsuit first started, and then somehow or another we got put into Sea Alaska at large. This land we used to live on there. In fact, we had a nice, beautiful, warm home there, well insulated. And the federal government came and told my father, he says, if you don't move off of this land, he said, we'll have to throw you in jail because you're keeping your children out of school. So as a result, we had to move. I can remember that when I was a little kid. We moved to a town of Klawock to a house that wasn't insulated. As a result, two of my brothers died of pneumonia. We couldn't keep the house warm. And so the land we moved from used to belong